Brian Had a Dream, 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000.
Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome back to the quest for 10,000, our audio journey with Brian as he tries to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. We are getting very, very close to the 10,000th movie. We're also getting very, very close to Brian's birthday. So for this episode, we are going to fly through movies 9,996 to 9,999 so that we can make both of our deadlines. You can join the conversation again by following Brian on Twitter at 10K, T-E-N-K Movies, or on his blog, 10kmovies.com. Before we get into our review of four films back to back to back to back, and then our top five also of Brian's top five short films, since we're going to be doing short synopses of these feature length pictures, I thought, why not do a review of some smaller fare? But we should just probably say we've been away for a while. We've been a little bit more hit or miss. We've said this before on the podcast. I take most of the full blame and brunt of that. My job just has not left much time for doing other things. But I promise we're gonna make this deadline as we record and edit and get these out. If for nobody else, then for the two of us who have done this labor of love, hearing about you talk about all the different movies that you have watched. So just want to let folks know that if you are listening to any of these, you're going to get a number of episodes back to back to back. We do have the 10,000th episode in the can. I just got to edit the thing. And I think you're going to enjoy it, or at least hopefully not think we are absolute morons as we talk about.
I wouldn't say that. I take a little issue with you saying it's not mostly your fault. You know, things get in the way. We can't always make time. Schedules don't always intersect. But this labor of love is almost delivered. So we've almost gone the distance, and now we're taking it into the final home stretch.
Well, and also we have to hit the deadline too, because new addition coming to Brian's family very soon. So I talk about schedules and timing not working out. There's going to be a whole new world of that for you as well. So without much further ado, then let's dive into this episode. Another little Aquaman pun from our last episode. So, Brian, tell us the movies we're going to talk about here in this episode.
Well, first off, we're going to talk about last year's Best Actor winner, Bohemian Rhapsody. Then we're going to talk about Glass, starring Samuel L. Jackson. Then we will talk about another superhero movie that came out earlier this year, Captain Marvel, with Samuel L. Jackson also, and this is developing a theme. And then the last movie that we'll talk about will not have Samuel L. Jackson appearing, and it is a Netflix film, a little depressing, but an eye-opener, Paddleton.
Okay. And the way we're going to do this, just to keep things moving, is that Brian is going to share a high point of each movie, a low point, a question that comes from the film, and then your main takeaway from each film. During the question part, that's probably when I might pipe in a little bit, and we might unpack that question a little bit, but we're going to try to keep going so we can get these movies and the top five all in a neat and tidy 20 to 28 minutes, as most of our episodes have been. So
it's a speed run.
So, lead it off. High point of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Well, the high point was the recreation of the famous Live Aid concert. From the moment that they start performing or reenacting that scene, it's transfixing for me. I mean, it was wonderful. That part was. The low point would be a lot of the stuff at the beginning about the band in general and their dynamic. There just wasn't enough. Like, I know who, and I knew going in who Brian May and Freddie Mercury were. I don't really know that I can name the other members of Queen, and having watched the movie, I still can't.
That seems like it would be a problem.
I'm just saying, those were characters in the movie, true, but nobody talked about them. And I just feel like if you're going to do that, you're going to flesh them out. Takeaway, good movie. The final part, if you like Queen, if you like music from the 80s, the final 5 minutes or so, 20 minutes or so is phenomenal. My question is, would the movie have been better served if Bryan Singer had never been involved?
That's a good question. Another question I've heard related to this movie was, really sure this was a good movie? Malick was great. There were really cool scenes.
And I will say, it won Best Editing. And I know a lot of people I know who wins Oscars and I have opinions, but I don't know. I'm not, knowledgeable enough to know what movies should win Best Editing. But the people in the know about that say it's a joke and a travesty that this movie was horribly edited. And part of that is because it's really two different movies kind of mishmashed together. Bryan Singer's and Dexter Fletcher's, the director who came in to save the movie. So I think the movie would have been a better movie if Singer had never been involved. But then the question is, would it have been made without Singer's involvement? Number two, we're talking about Glass, starring Samuel L. Jackson. I love love the way that M. Night Shyamalan, more or less like a mid-career renaissance, with Split, the stealth sequel to Unbreakable, right? Nobody knew this movie was coming. It wasn't on anybody's radar, and it wasn't until the very last scene of the movie that you realize, holy crap, this is a sequel.
Right.
But I love bringing Mr. Glass back. I love, creating your own superhero universe kind of organically without any fanfare. The movie wasn't as... The high point was Samuel Jackson as Mr. Glass.
Of course.
He was great. The point was it felt sort of a little too bloated, not as organic as it could have been.
Was that because of the three, I would say, fairly good actors all having to share scenery in McAvoy, Willis, and Jackson?
Yeah, I mean, in this movie at least, in Unbreakable at least, I would say that Bruce Willis is probably the least interesting of the three. And I think that sort of tracks with where his career is right now. Not anything bad
right.
about Bruce, but just saying that it is a difficult thing for action genre movie stars to gracefully decline into older roles or to become that sort of, he's 60 now.
Unless your name happens to be Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, but you just have to do it differently. Like, I don't know, but anyhow, he's the least interesting part of the movie. And that is the low point probably, was the sort of disappointment of Bruce Willis in the film. And his son is in it, and all three of them. Like, I did like that all three of the characters had somebody that was working with them to help them accomplish their goal. And I did like that the point was to, like, get the secret information out to the public, right? And Bruce Willis's character's son is, like, working with him to track down crime and stop crime. There were parts of it I really, really liked. But my biggest takeaway is that I hope that this is not the end for M. Night. I hope that he can continue to reinvent and surprise us.
Yes, your takeaway is actually anticipation, which is not something people would say after a lot of his films.
He had a role where he became a sort of a parody of who we all thought he was, right? And I would say, Last Airbender, not a good movie. The one with Will Smith and his son, not a good movie. He had some duds, but between Split and this, he seems to me to be back on the right track.
So what's your question?
Well, my question is, what will he do next?
All right.
Will this series sort of continue to expand? Is this just a trilogy and it's done? Will he try to move on to something else? So Captain Marvel came out in February, the movie before Endgame, the final movie of Phase, or getting towards the end of Phase 3 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I enjoyed this movie. I think the highlight was just the Kree and getting a better look at them and getting them firmly put into the Marvel Universe and the possibilities that sort of opens up. Because when you have a race of people that can mimic and take the shape of anybody that they come in contact with, it clearly opens up all sorts of storytelling possibilities. And so you get excited about that. You get excited about where that could lead.
I will point to one other highlight in that film, for me personally, is the upending of the cliche at the very end, the climactic battle, you know, she stands triumphant, and he, the bad guy played by Jude Law, is like, ah, that's right, you proved it, you know, and everything I taught you, and now you are, and she just like, like, I don't need to prove anything to you. Like, I just thought that was perfect in so many ways. I mean, the commentary that is for women empowerment and the strength of women and not having to be defined in relation to a man, I thought was great, and I thought it was just a really satisfying conclusion for that character's story arc at that point in the movie too. So I really loved that.
I will say one thing, another semi-highlight that I enjoyed was the prequel, being a prequel without being losing dramatic tension, which is hard to do, but also like seeing Coulson back in the MCU, seeing, you know, these characters pop back up and making it, it felt better because of it. If this movie had taken place in the 80s, but those characters weren't there, it would have felt inauthentic, so I like that. And I like the origin of Samuel Jackson's. I like including that sort of a Easter egg for fans. So that was a good point. The low point was probably, to be honest, it felt like Annette Bening was a little bit wasted.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It felt like her character. I mean, her character was cool in a way, but it's like it was a glorified cameo, right? I mean, she didn't really do enough because like. The bar for older actors who joined in the MCU late, there are two that stand out, and one of them is Robert Redford in Winter Soldier, and then, you know, him, and then Michael Douglas in Ant-Man and Ant-Man the Wasp.
Sure.
Those were well used, great. You got an icon in this movie, and they're acting like it. And she was just, she could have been anybody. I mean, anybody could have done that, and it wouldn't have been any better or worse, so I felt like she was wasted.
Yep. So what was your takeaway?
Okay, one of my biggest takeaways was just the surprise I felt at how fun the Coulson character was and how most of the Marvel movies don't have that sort of like every man who has no powers, who's just on the team but doesn't really have any special abilities other than maybe a gun. That they don't have that character, or there doesn't seem to be enough of those characters, and how much fun that character is.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that movie, now that you mention it, is you have at the end like the most powerful character we've ever seen in the Marvel Universe, but also contrasted with the most maybe vulnerable, because they're mortal characters: Nick Fury, Coulson, her friend Monica Rambeau. Yeah, so that is pretty cool.
I mean, you can argue that Black Widow and Hawkeye don't really have superheroes. But I mean, Hawkeye can, you know, he has a superhuman ability with a bow and arrow. And Black Widow, obviously, she's incredibly gifted at fighting and skills and stuff that you can't imagine Coulson or Fury possess those skills.
Yeah, but that contrast really resonated.
Stand-ins for us than those two ever could.
So that contrast really resonated with you. That's cool. What's your question there?
My question is, what do you do with the Captain Marvel 2? Like, where do you go from here? How do you make a villain who can challenge her in a believable way? Because, you know, she is, for all intents and purposes of the movie, she's just developing her powers, but it seems like it's potential that she's omnipotent, right?
Yeah, well, especially if you've seen part of Endgame. So,
I mean, it feels like she has no limits to her powers.
Well, it's that Superman cliche, right?
Yeah, it is a Superman question. Like, what do you do? Now, with Superman, they said, okay, we have kryptonite. And that works in some ways, but you can't, you know, the flip side to that is he's got this one fatal flaw that all you got to do is get some kryptonite and he can't do anything. So it's just a tough balance to achieve between making a believable, like, adversary and making her so powerful she can't have a believable adversary. So.
Right. All right, well, we now are at 9,999. Paddleton?
Paddleton, yeah.
Tell folks a little bit about this. This may have been a gem people did not get a chance to notice.
Gem may not be the right word. It's a depressing movie. So if you're going into it thinking you're going to be as entertained as you were by any of the three others, you'll be somewhat disappointing.
It's a Netflix movie, right?
Yeah, it's a Netflix original. Stars Mark Duplass and Ray Romano, and they pretty much, there are a few other characters, but they're in 90% of the movie. It's just the interaction.
I watched this and couldn't get through after about an hour in.
That's sort of sad, because it's only like an hour and a half. So
maybe it was 45 minutes.
Spoiler alert, he dies.
Martin Duplass dies because he's diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Not in real life, but,
his character, right.
It's two characters. It's Martin Duplass and Ray Romano. And Martin Duplass' character finds out he has cancer, and he asks his best friend, Ray Romano, to accompany him while he goes to a state where assisted suicide is legal so that he can end his life on his terms.
Yeah, very, and very uplifting.
It's sweet in places. It's tough in places. It asks. Movies like this, it's always hard to make a recommendation on movies like this because a lot of how you feel about it will depend on how you feel about the issue at hand. If you find that to be an offensive issue and it makes you angry, then you're going to be angry at the movie. But to me, it's balanced. It asks tough questions about what it means to be someone's friend, what loyalty means, what it means to help someone. You know, because you think, on one hand, you think to yourself, the goal of a friend is to help someone live, not help someone end their life. So, but it's very good, and it's eye-opening. The highlight for me was Ray Romano. He's so good in it. Since post Everybody Loves Raymond, he has really been very choosy about the things he's been in. But his most recent output makes you realize that he could have been a pretty consistent dramatic actor if he had wanted to.
Oh, that's cool.
Because, I mean, he was in this and The Big Sick, and he was good in it, too. So.
It seems maybe obvious what the low light of it was, but is there anything more you want to say about the way the movie
tends to drag a little bit? But, you know, sad movies have their place.
True. So.
But yeah, that is the low point. isn't like a miraculous, you know, solution to the problem. It is what, you know, it is what they advertise it to.
And it sounds like you probably already covered your takeaway too, in that it just asks tough questions about friendship and what that means and
does.
Those sorts
and
of
it,
things.
And it just asks tough questions about what it means to be someone's friend.
So would that also be, I guess, your question and your takeaway are the same thing for this one?
Well, that, and I'll ask the question of, like, what will Romano and Duplass, I mean, I when Ray Romano's in something, I'm curious to see what it's going to be. His especially his post-Everybody Loved Raymond career has been extremely fascinating to me. Sort of like he did something, he made so much money, he can never run out of money. So now he can just do whatever the hell he wants to, and his choices have been fascinating.
Well, those are all fascinating takeaways and questions from these four films. Sad movies have their place. Action movies have their place. All these movies probably have their own place and a place on your list. You are living proof.
Some of them was in the toilet.
Well, I'm sure the top five we have today, though, their place is very high on your list. Short films. I think it just makes sense to talk about these since part of how you got to 10,000 as quickly as you did was thanks in no small part to these sorts of films. I mean, you can watch a bunch of them and really hike up your average of movies per day.
It's stat padding. I mean, you can say what you want to with it.
But
I mean,
there are some really...
They're eligible to win their own Academy Award. They're a movie.
Yeah, and some of them are really good.
Really saying, you're saying that because before 1915, 1916, no movie was longer than 30 minutes. So you're saying those aren't movies? Well, of course they are. They're just a different type of movie.
Just a different movie. Well, tell us what your top five are. I'm sure you have some honorable mentions as well.
Well,
so run down those for us.
A few quickly that didn't quite make the cut, but Duck Dodgers in the 24th and One Half Century. Several
classic
movies didn't quite make the cut, like Duck Amuck, What's Opera Doc, one Disney movie that came out with Frozen, that came out in front of it called Get a Horse. It was phenomenal. And then one Pixar movie, Jerry's Game, where he's playing this old man playing chess in the park. I know you've probably seen it.
Yes.
Honorable mention. Great movies, not quite in the top five. But number five was, it won Best Documentary Short several years ago. It's a very sweet movie. It's called The Lady in Number Six. It's about a lady that survived the Holocaust as a child because, in essence, because she could play the piano. They needed somebody to play the piano when visiting dignitaries came through, so she played. And now she's, at this point, she was 100-something years old and still giving piano lessons. And then, and, you know, she talks about how music was what saved her life. And it's a very sweet movie, very inspirational. She has since deceased, but that, you know, I love that movie. Number four is a short black and white movie from 1928. Probably not a lot of people have heard of it. The only reason I had heard of it is because it was put on the National Film Registry. It's called There It Is. It's got some neat little stop-motion stuff going on into it. As this guy comes to investigate what they call the Fuzz Face Phantom. It's nice. Silly, but it's fun, and I'm a sucker for stop-motion stuff, but it could fit in even today, so it was very good. Number three is a movie I'm sure you're familiar with. It's a Warner Brothers short, One Froggy Evening.
Yes.
I don't think they can make a short much better than the singing frog that refuses to sing in front of anybody but the man that discovers him. I think it's perfect. And I think there's a reason why Michigan J. Frog has become sort of the Warner Brothers mascot, because that movie, to me, stands the test of time. Number two is another Oscar winner. This one, Best Animated Short in the 70s, and it's sort of a weird movie, and it's sort of an informative movie, but it's called Great. It is more or less a British version of Schoolhouse Rock for you know, and it's probably about 10, no, it's about 28 minutes, but it's about this guy that I'd never heard of called, it is Sombard Kingdom Brunel, and he was an English engineer in the middle of the 19th century. Who was responsible for a lot of the Industrial Revolution. But it's just, like I said, it feels like a British Schoolhouse Rock, and I really enjoyed it. And the best short film that I have seen, and this movie clocks in at 40 minutes, so it's cusping on the border of no longer being short, but for my purposes, I'm calling it that. It's also a silent movie from the 20s, but it's Sherlock Jr., starring Buster Keaton. I am a huge Buster Keaton fan. To me, the question of him, I mean, there's a big question. You know, if you like Sodom, the question is, are you Chaplin or Keaton? For me, the question is definitively Keaton. But it's inventive. It's funny. It holds up well. And so I'm a big Buster fan. I'm a big Sherlock Jr.
As long as it's not that weird pig movie you made me watch several episodes ago.
His tongue starts moving. Oh my gosh! No, it's nightmare inducing.
Listeners,
it really is. Like, what were people smoking in 1907 that someone thought this was? And it's wait, no, it's not on the list. I mean, the majority of the movies that I've seen that are early 20th centuries in 1900s and early 1910s, they're not that good.
Well, listeners, that's Brian's list. Well, what's your list? Feel free to share with Brian on Twitter at 10kmovies, on his blog 10kmovies.com. Let us know if you've seen any of these or what other ones Brian hasn't yet checked out. Chances are he has, but you never know. This is 9,999. 10,000 is coming next. And fittingly, that is going to be Avengers Endgame. Our 10,000th episode is a two-part episode. We just couldn't fit everything we needed to in one half hour. And then also we will do, probably after Brian turns 40, sort of a coda to all this, kind of just a short summation episode as well. But we are in the home stretch. We are in the endgame now. And we hope you will continue with us. We thank you for being with us so far. And until we do come back with Endgame, we hope your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Borderline 11.